You are listening to the Freight Buyers Club, a home for those interested in international trade, shipping, procurement, logistics, and air freight. In fact, all things supply chain in the Americas, Asia, and beyond. This podcast is brought to you by your host, Mike King, and produced in partnership with Demerco Express Group, a global 3PL that specializes in managing logistics to, from, and within the Asia-Pacific region.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Freight Buyers Club, which, as you've just heard, is produced with the support of Demerco Express Group. I'm Mike King, and you can find this episode and many more on all podcast platforms and on YouTube, along with a bunch of shorter video interviews. You can also find all this content on thefreightbuyersclub.com, where you can subscribe to get each episode direct to your inbox. And you really should do. Let me give you an idea of what's coming up, because the episode after this is the final one of the year, and it features not one, but two big hitters from the world of container shipping supply chains. We have Journal of Commerce veteran Peter Tershwell here to tell us how he's finding life over in Asia, and he's joined by Vespucci Maritime founder Lars Jensen. In this Christmas special, we'll be looking back at this rather crazy year for supply chains, and we'll be looking ahead to 2025. So please do sign up, subscribe, or follow wherever you get your podcasts. As you'll hear today, there really is a lot to digest ahead of the new year. Okay, in the here and now, I'm delighted to say a little later, we'll be hearing what's going on in Asia and how people are preparing for a new US government when I speak to Kathy Liu, Vice President of Global Sales and Marketing at Demerco Express Group. But first, I'm delighted to say, joining me today are two very well-known figures in the world of supply chain consultancy and economics. First, it's one of the world's leading supply chain experts. He's also the Director of Transportation Consulting at S&P Global Market Intelligence, Paul Bingham. Welcome back to the Freight Buyers Club.
Thank you, Mike. Great to be back with you today.
Thanks for coming on. And my next guest wears a number of hats, not least as founder of Logistics Trends and Insights, a leading market research firm. He's also a highly respected research analyst at Journal of Commerce and a highly prized ex-colleague of my own. Welcome back, Kathy Robeson.
Hi, Mike. How you doing?
I'm good. Good to see you. Okay, guys, I want to talk about tariffs and geopolitics shortly, but that's not the only story out there. As we record this on 26th of November, there is a big story breaking, which might well end up tying in to the geopolitical situation. We've had heightened security around the potential for explosives being moved through parcels networks since last summer, when there was a series of dangerous incidents. One incendiary caused a warehouse fire in the UK, another caught fire in a lorry in Poland, and then another one caught fire in DHL's hub in Leipzig, Germany. US and European security was tightened up. Security officials have previously told Reuters and various other publications that these explosions in Europe were part of a possible test run for a Russian plot to trigger explosions and cargo flights to the United States. Now we have had this awful DHL airplane crash on the approach to Vilnius Airport, with one crew member confirmed dead and three others in hospital. The aircraft operated by Swift Air had flown to Lithuania from DHL's Leipzig hub. Kathy, I must stress that we don't know what caused this incident at this stage, but Lithuanian officials have said their exploring of this was Russian sabotage, while Germany's foreign minister raised the possibility that this could be a hybrid war incident coming after sea cables were cut in the Baltic. Kathy, what does this incident mean for parcel networks and security until we know definitively that this wasn't an attack on those networks?
Until we know for sure, and even when we do know for sure, security is going to be heightened even further on these types of transportation legs. We had the same issue happened over the summer. And as a result of that, the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, they're clamping down on security imports, rather, regardless if it's parcels or what have you. And back in August, they issued a statement declaring no more vague descriptions of imports coming in. Like, you can't sit there and say it's a gift or it's parts. You have to be specific in what you're importing into the U.S. now. So for e-commerce that's moving in, that paperwork's got to be specific, and it can't just necessarily say e-commerce. On top of that, like I said, the Customs Border and Patrol Protection, I should say, they're clamping down more, particularly with the de minimis As you recall, back in the summer, they basically fined or limited, slapped hands, whatever you want to call it, to a number of customs brokers. So they are definitely cracking down from a security perspective. From a parcel perspective, I think we're going to continue seeing cross-border e-commerce or whatever parcel related, but it's going to cost more from additional rates, additional surcharges, what have you.
How busy have those parcel networks been this Q4? As we're talking, this is normally the peak of that holiday season market for air cargo, for integrators. What sort of peak season would you say it's been before I get a wider view from Paul on the economy?
Well, maybe in one word, it'd be kind of meh. So it's probably about as normal as it's going to get from a parcel perspective, integrator perspective. One thing going for UPS in particular is its U.S. post office contract. So it is moving more parcels from an air domestic perspective. But globally, it's still a struggle for the integrators, e-commerce, which has been a great volume producer for air cargo as a whole. That hasn't necessarily translated into profits, perhaps revenue, but from a profitability perspective, it's still a question mark.
I'm going to come back to you a bit later on some of those e-commerce rules, particularly around de minimis, but park that for a second. Paul, if I can bring you in here, two things there. Donald Trump, he's getting inaugurated on the 20th of January. One thing in his intro is this possible increased security threat. The other is the economy, which he says he's got all of the answers for. What sort of shape would you say the economy is in as we draw towards the end of the year?
Well, we've had a very strong 2024. Our forecast for the end of the year GDP growth is 2.7. We're near full employment still. There's, you know, unemployment has had some slight upticks, and then we, in fact, are forecasting that to increase in 2025. But the bottom line is our forecast, even before the election, was for a softening of the economy in 2025. A weaker growth, though still growth. Our forecast prepared right before the election with some assumptions about various policies had 2% growth. And the next forecast that we do, which will take into account a few more of the most recent policy proposals coming from the incoming Trump administration, is likely to be downgraded a little bit further in terms of expectations for 2025 growth. So it's a slowing economy, but not one that at least so far is showing a recession for a number of factors, including the lingering effects of the high interest rates that have been in place now for a long time that have been coming down, but slowly. You know, we still have elevated interest rates that affects cost of capital, it affects consumer finance, it affects spending behavior. And that's a dampening factor that's not going to reverse quickly, you know, no matter what policy changes are adopted by the incoming Trump administration and Congress in 2025.
Well, we're getting some idea of what some of those policies might be. Almost live as we record this, Donald Trump has now pledged to introduce 25% tariffs on products from Mexico and Canada, an extra 10% on Chinese imports when he formally enters the White House. That might only be three countries, but that's around about 40% of total US trade right there. What does this mean for the US economy? I mean, also for that US-Mexico-Canada agreement, USMCA, that Trump actually negotiated himself and now seems to be threatening to rip up on Truth Social, not the normal diplomatic channel. This has all got to be bad news for US importers and exports, maybe also for those overall trade volumes, isn't it?
Well, clearly. Tariffs are inflationary in their impact on the economy and very likely will be trade partner retaliation against the U.S. imposition of tariffs. So it ends up affecting trade in both directions. As prices increase through the imposition of tariffs, that affects the demand. And that's fundamental to economics, not particularly even to trade relationships. It's any relationship if you raise prices sufficiently, you know, with the exception of very few goods that have what's called inelastic demand. But that means trade volumes will likely be lower than the baseline forecast under imposition of tariffs. And how those play out are not clear, except that it is clear that the president, under a number of different existing laws, some of which were used by the first Trump administration in 2016, 2017, 2018, are policies he can adopt without going through Congress. He doesn't need to wait for Congress. He can impose them unilaterally almost immediately. And it's not clear that that's going to be day one, but the policy statements coming out now, like the one we've just heard, those could be very rapid in terms of their imposition. And therefore, the impact on the economy can be pretty quick. It doesn't have to wait for phasing in. Though the precedent was not all of the tariffs that were announced during the first Trump administration took effect immediately. There were sometimes advanced notice given on the effective date, which allowed for companies to apply for waivers for some mitigation trading activity where there was some advancement and pull ahead of imports ahead of tariffs. And it's possible that that same pattern could take place in 2025 under the new administration with some of these policies when the details come out. And that's part of what we're waiting for, is to get the details on how much, when, into what commodities specifically they will be applied and under what conditions they might change after the initial imposition. The proposal yesterday seemed to be specifically related to immigration, the border, and attempts to forestall fentanyl imports. And it's not clear what the evidence, what the metrics would be to measure the response on the part of the targeted tariffs countries of basically our major trade partners, the biggest trade partners we have of Mexico, China, and Canada.
We've got a few policies possibly coming in. We don't know the detail, and the devil always is in the detail. But if we've got tighter immigration restrictions, if we've got low corporation tax, if we've got higher tariffs, most economists say that is inflationary. The Republican people around Trump, some of them are economists, they say it's not going to do that. It's going to drive growth. It's going to drive investment. It's going to hurt international rivals to the US. Why is there that massive difference in opinion on this?
Well, there's clearly some divergence of thought on this and arguments that attach different weights to factors at work. So, you know, one of the arguments that has some credibility is that there's some changes in foreign direct investment flows. If you protect a market with the tariff wall, you would tend to have foreign companies that want to continue to participate in that market potentially invest more for domestic production. And maybe that includes, you know, U.S. and Canada under the USMCA under certain circumstances where they would still be, though yesterday's policy may not allow for that. But the point is that there may be some offset where you reduce the trade deficits that we have with some of those trade partner countries as a country for the United States and see some offset in terms of the earnings of American workers as opposed to the foreign workers that are being substituted for. But the bottom line for us as the macroeconomists in S&P are still overall, it looks like the breadth of the potential policies could be extensive enough that the net result will almost certainly in our minds be inflationary, at least in the short run, because you can't substitute domestic production instantly for categories of goods that are almost exclusively produced offshore and imported into the United States. You know, for example, 80% of our cell phones come from China still. So you put the tariffs on those, it's not as if that production and that consumption can be substituted for with domestic production instantly. So in that category, you know, almost certainly to be inflationary. I should add one more point to this, though, is that if foreign countries devalue their currencies against the U.S. dollar, that can help offset some of the tariff rates. If you devalue a foreign currency enough against the U.S. dollar, you know, that can be lowering the U.S. dollar price of that import, which may offset the tariff. Obviously, if that happens, it puts at a greater disadvantage U.S. exporters trying to sell into those markets with a stronger dollar, which then makes those U.S. exports not price competitive, even if there were no retaliatory tariffs. But that's another factor at work that would argue that perhaps it's not quite so inflationary if you strengthen the dollar substantially to offset the tariff amounts being imposed.
Lots to watch there. I want to come back to some of the long-term implications in a moment. But Kathy, looking in the more immediate near term, next January in particular, aside from tariffs, we also have a possible shutdown at US East Coast and Gulf Coast ports from January the 15th if the ILA union and port interests represented by USMX fail to reach an agreement on automation just before Trump's inauguration on January 20th. We've also got factory closures in China for the Lunar New Year at the end of January. And some big changes coming in January and early February is the ocean shipping alliance system. shippers have incentives to get cargo in now if they can. Are you hearing about much front loading of imports? And are you expecting shipping and air cargo markets to tighten in the coming weeks?
Honestly, no. And the reason why I say that is, you know, retailers and other shippers front loaded a lot of imports prior to the September 30th, the original September 30th contract deadline. And we saw ocean freight imports continue to be strong at least through October. But since then, it's kind of drifted downwards, perhaps because of the upcoming end of year holiday season and such as that. I think there's a wait and see among a lot of retailers in particular. And according to a lot of those that have already announced their Q3 earnings, a lot of them have already said they're prepared. They have enough inventory. In fact, inventory levels right now are a little higher than usual, but that's typically the case leading into a peak holiday season. So we'll see how long this can hold, but a lot of these retailers have already diversified their sourcing, like away from China. They've moved more into Southeast Asia, also Mexico. So we'll see there. So they said they're prepared for that. Now, as far as the potential contract, the port contract not being approved by January 15th, that may be a concern. In fact, it will be a concern. There'll be a lot more shifting over towards the West Coast. There'll be use of air freight, of course. But right now, doesn't seem to be a lot of activity going on. There's still a lot of wait and see.
I can't believe that an incoming president won't force some sort of settlement, whether that's forcing the unions to work.
Well, look who he's named as labor secretary. Okay, so the Teamsters have endorsed this person. If they do get approved, I think they still have to get approved by Congress. I'm not sure. But it is a very pro-union person. So I think, honestly, I think Trump will force somebody's hand, namely the USMX, I think, to come to terms.
Consisting of a lot of foreign container shipping lines at the heart of USMX. Yeah. Quite an easy target. The automation argument is quite interesting because it seems like they're trying to turn back time. I don't want to sound like Cher all of a sudden, but...
Where's your wig, Mike?
Yeah. I tell you what, if anyone needs a wig on YouTube, it's me.
But honestly, I mean, it's an interesting argument because not only are the ILA, ILWA, all of them have been anti-automation, but also our friends up in Canada, the Canadian port workers have also cited automation. Also, the Canadian Post Office, the Canada Post Office, which is on strike right now, they've also noted automation as a concern. But I find it very ironic because there is automation.
There is. But where do you stop automation? I mean, and where does health and safety and automation, where does one start and the other finish? Because some automation does actually help health and safety.
Well, there's automation at the Savannah port.
Yeah.
You know, at a number of East Coast ports already. So why all of a sudden is this a huge concern?
Well, we will see how that plays out. Let's pause there and hear how all of these new policies and this new administration is looking from Asia. I spoke to Kathy Liu, Vice President of Global Sales and Marketing at Demerco Express Group, who is based in Shanghai. I started by asking her how freight markets and shippers had reacted to the news that Trump had won the election and how they were feeling about the trade wars being ramped up.
Yeah, he just announced that he will add on extra 10% of the tariff for those China export goods, or let's say import from China goods into US. But at the same time, he actually also announced the similar tariff increase for Mexico, Canada, and also other countries potentially. So I think for sure it will impact on the trading between China and the US, but because of looks like Trump like to apply the tariff to everybody. So maybe it will be not only limited to China. But by the end of the day, I think most of the people already realize that the consumer, the end consumer in US will need to pay for that extra tariff, whatever, for what kind of commodity. So everybody, I think now in, especially like in China, the shippers or customers are wait and see what will exactly happen after Trump on board and then take further action. So far, there's very, I mean, at least in China, it's very quiet.
Do you think this is going to prompt more people to move their sourcing or their supply chain processes out of China to Southeast Asia, to South Asia or Latin America? Is this going to change that? Is this going to speed things up now? Are people realizing that whether you're a foreign company or a Chinese company, that you need to maybe diversify that supply?
Yeah, I think like the China Plus One strategy already applied to the most of those foreign companies that normally have production line in China. And they already start to diversify their production out of China, start from 2022, if I remember correctly. Yeah, right after the COVID. So it's already a certain time for the process. And what we have seen is most of those customers, they start to, for the trial run in this year, 2024, to try to produce the finished goods in those countries like Thailand, Malaysia, India, Vietnam, and then it will be put into massive production start from next year. So let's say this kind of process already in place for 2 years, and then now it's already getting to the stage that they will have the massive production from next year. So it's not really because of Trump, but also they already consider this kind of, let's say, potential risk after the COVID time period.
Did you see any big rush to get cargo into the US before these tariffs come in? We've also got Chinese New Year at the end of January, so not long after Trump's inauguration.
This year, it's it's a little bit different compared with years ago. We see that the air freight market is at high level start right after Chinese New Year of 2024. So in this area, we talk about there's no slow season in the whole year. But the same thing is that up to now, we also didn't see really peak season compared with years ago. So this year is really a little bit unique. And for ocean freight, the peak season is getting earlier. They start already this year from April, May, June, and now it's very quiet. So this year it's really a little bit different. So we also didn't see that the customers or shippers trying to book space in advance and to try to arrange the cargoes arrive before end of December. This trend we also didn't see. Normally, when we know that Trump will be the president, the market actually is expect that more customer or more shippers will arrange like that. But until now, we didn't see this kind of wave. And still, it's full of e-commerce in the market. There's no other productions.
Okay, so there's a big focus on the e-commerce market. I mean, we on the ocean shipping side, according to Drew, we had a 5% spot rate drop from Shanghai to LA if you're booking a slot there, which is a little bit of a surprise to me because you can still get your cargo on a vessel now and be in before tariffs, even if they came in on day one. But there hasn't been any big rush to book up some ocean shipping space.
Yeah, like I mentioned earlier, that everybody that I meet here actually is wait and see. People not really taking any actions because you know that Trump talk a lot during the election period, but we don't know how much it will be materialized. So people are actually holding back and wait and see what will happen. And also on the other hand, because of some of those production already moved out of China. So there's no urgency to arrange it like immediately or take the reaction immediately within this year. Because one hand, you still can export already from Southeast Asia. And another hand, even there's still some a certain percentage within China because the tariff is not really something materialized or something already firmed. So people actually is holding back and see what's going on.
On the air cargo market, obviously it's been, you mentioned there, we've had a peak season, but it wasn't quite as accentuated as it was last year. But it sort of was a longer peak because it was quite a tight market from the summer almost. But does this continue into 2025? We've got the possibility of the change in the US de minimis rules, which could impact the likes of Temu and Shein, who are able to fly products valued at less than $800 in direct to consumers in the US without paying any import duties or taxes right now under the current regime. Would that be a shock to the system if those rules changed?
I think both Temu, Shein or any other like TikTok, AliExpress, they are already prepared for that. Because this kind of intention from the US government to lower down the tax-free amount already for a while. So I think they all prepare for that. And while our conversation in the past with those e-commerce players, they already start to plan certain like the overseas warehouse in US. And then in the future, they will not use that much effort, but ocean freight instead, get into the US market first and store in the warehouse and then deliver to the final consumers. So this is not really impacted by this kind of regulation. And on the other hand, like a Temu, the average value per parcel actually is around about $50 to $100. So if you still keep 800 tax-free, if not 500, it's not that much impact on those users on Temu, because the value of the products they sell on Temu actually is very, very low. But like Shein, they have their own brand, maybe it will be impacted. And also from these 2 years, because those big e-commerce platforms, they are also already collect enough big data to know the consumer behavior in different markets, for sure, including in US. So it also will help them to analyze how to move their logistic or supply chain in the coming future. Like what I mentioned, that they will move those most frequently ordered products by ocean freight in US first to store in the warehouse. And then based on the orders, and then they deliver within US via domestic transportation. And only those maybe high value or those seldom ordered items, it will be shipped out from China directly. That's what we see the trend in 2025. So overall, air freight market, I mean, for e-commerce will be reduced in the coming years. That's for sure.
Tough news for people in that air cargo supply chain. Kathy Liu, Vice President of Global Sales and Marketing at the Mirco Express Group. Thanks for joining me today on the Freight Buyers Club.
Thank you, Mike.
Kathy, what's your view on whether Trump will reform the de minimis rules, and what does this mean for importers and the integrators and air freight companies that handle a lot of this traffic?
You know, that's a really good question. There's been a number of bills sitting in Congress for well over a year, going on 2 years, about trying to figure out what to do with de minimis. Some of these bills include cutting out those countries, namely Russia and China, that don't reciprocate because neither one of them offer any type of a de minimis. Others are for lowering the de minimis. So I think we're going to see some kind of a change in de minimis. But it's interesting because folks that I talked to at the TIAACA Air Cargo Forum a few weeks ago, I asked them about de minimis. And a lot of them believe that, if anything, the de minimis will be lowered from 800 to probably 200 or somewhere in between. That seems to be the going consensus at the moment. As far as an impact, boy, I couldn't tell you, to be honest with you. I think like our friend or the integrator friends like UPS, FedEx, DHL, they're all part of the Customs Border and Protection group that's been monitoring, testing out different technologies and such towards this. So I honestly don't think it's going to change from a volume perspective. I think the volume is basically here and it's going to continue as is. So.
As Kathy Liu said earlier as well, most of those shipments from the likes of Temu and Shein coming in at an average price that's a lot less than $200. Paul, what does these things that we've been discussing, more tariffs, maybe some changes to the de minimis rules, we discussed what this meant for the US economy. How does this impact China and its economic growth?
Well, from the Chinese economy faces several headwinds, of which this would be an additional one in terms of achieving their planned and desired growth. They'd themselves set a 5% GDP growth target for 2024, which they're going to miss. We're forecasting that Chinese growth, despite stimulus efforts on the part of the Chinese government, to come in at 4.9% GDP growth for 2024, which for that economy is a low number. And we're forecasting that's going to fall already to 4.6% for 2025 without taking into account the full depth of the potential impacts on slowed export growth, on which their economy is still too dependent in terms of the mix. And they themselves have a policy to try to promote further consumption spending domestically within the economy in China. And mainland China has not been able to reach those targets. they're toying with deflation, which is another problem and unique one to mainland China right now in terms of prices. So there's a lot of challenges that are there, some of which are not so directly tied to trade, such as their housing market problems with so much investment and difficulties in the residential housing sector in China. And then they have the demographic problem where that is they're no longer the biggest population in the world because India has overtaken them and the outlook is for slower growth in an aging population, which means the potential for production and output and consumption is one for slower growth fundamentally long-term in mainland China. So there's some real headwinds there for that economy to continue to perform. It's not going to be able to return to the days of double-digit GDP growth. And long-term, that's a real challenge for them, even as an end market, as other countries surpass them, specifically as far as the biggest country and growth, faster growth in India.
With that U.S.-China relationship seeming like it's going to further deteriorate, we've also got on top of that all these other geopolitical risks in the Black Sea, in the Middle East, in the South China Sea. How do you factor all this in when you look at global trade and economic growth and you try to forecast where they'll go? There's a lot of unknowns out there.
Well, fortunately, in S&P, we have quite a few economists around the world that are monitoring it. And it's really done bottoms up. It's looking at country by country from a trade perspective, trade partner country by trade partner country for each of those economies and how they perform. Also, some impacts of the regionalization of trade as you have some countries that are forming into a bloc where we're not having globalization so much anymore as a regionalization of trade. You know, as we've seen with the sanctions against Russia, them trading more with countries like China and less with some of the Western countries. And similarly, a refocus perhaps on the part of the Western developed economies to trade more with themselves and then some of the emerging market countries going forwards, which means, you know, we have a future of trade composition and trade characteristics that's different from what we had seen for 20 years or longer going forwards, with not a lot of potential that would revert back towards sort of that global source from anywhere, global sell to anywhere perspective that many companies had for a long time. And that implies some inefficiencies, potentially some loss of what trade economists would call comparative advantage, higher costs, less selection, and perhaps less reliability in terms of trade potential, which ultimately results potentially in lower potential growth, you know, for the world economy as a whole.
Well, I want to come back to a few of those points in a minute, and let's also have a look at procurement strategies and the US domestic freight scene, box shipping and air cargo markets. But let's just take a short break for a moment.
This podcast is proudly produced in partnership with Demerco Express Group, a trusted provider of global shipping and contract logistics services in Asia, Europe, and North America. Demerco's particular strength is in Asia, where it gives shippers the freight capacity and local market expertise to streamline freight movements to and from the region, particularly for Trans-Pacific lanes. With 130 forwarding and logistics locations across China, India, and Southeast Asia, Demerco connects Asia with the world like no other global 3PL. You are listening to the Freight Buyers Club.
Welcome back. Paul, you touched on this before. This end of this trading system. This is sometimes referred to as China plus one. I was interviewing someone, Dan Bass at AgResource. He sees an emerging duopoly. So this is the US on the West on one side in terms of trade and the BRICS on the other side. It's almost like a new Cold War. How does what's happening next year play out for people who are looking where to invest? We've seen this trend of people investing more in Southeast Asia and Latin America. You mentioned regionalization. Is this going to keep driving that? There's a lot of things going on. How do you think people adapt to their procurement strategies next year and in the years beyond that?
Well, it's already been happening for years, so it's not new for supply chain managers looking for alternative sourcing, trying to diversify their supply chains, you know, the lessons learned during COVID and so forth.
Does this accelerate it, is my point?
Well, absolutely accelerate it. And if anything, add to the pressures that supply chain managers have to think about not just their primary supplier, but the tier supply chains, the vulnerability of those to disruption, to higher costs, and to understand then that full landed cost and the potential risks around it. That includes in the equation perhaps some more onshoring where you actually bring production back to the United States. but really done in a big picture view where you say, okay, well, that may not be the choice. Maybe it's still Mexico. Maybe it's Canada. Maybe it's another country in Southeast Asia, or perhaps even in Central Europe, despite the disruptions that are seen there, or Latin America, or even Africa in terms of some potential sourcing partners. And it's specific industry by industry, commodity by commodity, how those decisions really are made. It's not some global picture of saying, well, there's a new substitute for China as the manufacturing base for the world. That's not happening. We're going to be in a world of, you know, multi-party, more complexity around supply chains, but also more visibility and more attention and investment spent on monitoring those supply chains and trying to be agile to be able to have, you know, enough suppliers to minimize your risk, and not so many suppliers that it raises your costs, but try to balance that to try to assure that you have your supplies that you need and can serve the customers you're trying to serve in end markets. And the investment flows will follow that in terms of which countries the capital will flow into for production, and also for the end markets that companies will try to pursue, put capital into selling into, you know, de-emphasizing certain markets and putting more emphasis on selling to other markets if you're an export business.
Kathy, I was going to ask you how that plays out in terms of freight buyers, but I guess you might have already said they're already building in resilience by front-loading last year, building up those inventories. Do you see that continuing? People are just going to be playing cautious.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And from what Paul has said, I mean, it's supply chain costs are going to increase, and which is going to drive up. It could potentially drive up inflation for the end consumer as well. So the supply chain manager is going to really be put in the hot seat and trying to reduce those costs no matter what, you know, trying to find the best routes, the best sourcing, and so on and so forth. And they're going to end up using a lot more technology, I think, to help with all of this, and a lot of negotiation with the ocean freight carriers and air freight carriers from a global perspective.
Just if I might pivot there, and let's look a bit more at the US and that domestic freight market. A lot of trucking operators have had a couple of rough years. Are we seeing a recovery, an end to the great freight recession, I think someone called it? And will lighter regulation from the Trump team and maybe tax cuts help trucking or not?
As far as the end of the freight recession, I still think it's a little too early to call it, to be honest with you. Now, yeah, a number of truck carriers have reported a little bit better outlooks, forecasts and such for the end of this year and into next year, but they're not out of the woods yet. It's all going to be dependent on what happens in January, of course, and any type of consumer demand that may be out there. The consumer, it all rests on the consumer. The consumer could be a little tired of carrying the economy, and they're beginning to pull back. You're beginning to see that in a lot of these retailers' earnings call, Q3 announcements. The winners, the retailer winners, are these off-brand type of retail stores, not the major retailers. So we'll see.
Paul, if you want to come in on that, please do so. But I just wanted to throw something else out there. The Republicans are talking about this corporation tax cut from 21% to 15%. There's this view that this will boost long-term growth, but also some people have argued that it might give freight demand a boost too. S&P has argued that a corporation tax is more likely to be used to boost dividends rather than spare in investment and demand. Can you just explain that a little bit for us?
My colleagues over in S&P that focus intensely on the publicly traded, you know, corporate finance, on the corporate companies, they've done the research in the past when we've had changes in corporate tax rates, and they've seen some of that flow back through dividends to shareholders, shareholder value, rather than flowing entirely into new investment. And I think that's natural, that you would expect companies to try to judge what's appropriate for managing for the shareholder value and their stock price. You know, not so much just trying to maximize gross sales. In fact, we've seen an argument about that, you know, corporate America is focused on that balance between, you know, financial return and trying to expand sales. So that really remains to be seen what the details are, what the timing is, and some of the other offsets that those same companies may face in terms of economic conditions. Because if they see a weakening economy with sales potential is dropping, there may be less justification to allocating capital into adding capacity. Or conversely, if you see something on the upside with a little bit greater growth, than anticipated, then perhaps they would invest to capture perceptions of growth. But there's so many mix of policies here going on besides just the tax policy. And tax policy, by the way, unlike tariffs, does have to get through Congress. And it's not clear, even with Republican control of both houses, at least marginally, you know, exactly what will work out in changes to the tax law in terms of what companies will or consumers will actually be able to achieve from a number of tax policy. There's not only corporate tax policy. We've had income tax policy proposals during the campaign. And it's not clear exactly yet how those are going to work through Congress, with Congress having a say in tax policy.
Just a final word on tariffs, something that caught my eye. Citadel CEO Ken Griffin said tariffs will, well, he argued that the tariffs will shelter U.S. companies from foreign competition and make them less competitive. It would also make them more reliant on the continuance of these policies or gaining exemptions from them, both of which would incentivize building relations with government officials. There was a paper published last year by a bunch of leading academics called The Political Economy of Tariff Exemption Grants. Bear with me, everyone. I'll put a link in the show notes. This looked at thousands of tariff exemption requests throughout 2018 and 2019. And the authors found that a quid pro quo mechanism took effect, whereby firms that donated more to Republicans and less to Democrats were more likely to receive exemptions. The study also found that firms that hired lobbyists who were more connected to the Trump administration were more likely to receive exemptions. Is this sort of crony capitalism a concern at S&P or a risk for the economy in your own view?
Yeah, I'm not actually familiar with that one paper myself, but I do know that there's that longstanding, not even recent issue around, you know, the critics that say you have a high level of regulation and other controls from the government on the economy. This is the political economy literature that goes back years. Then more incentive is there for corporations and companies to spend money in the public sector trying to influence the policies that control them and bound their ability for action. So there's that argument around the tariffs. At the same time, you have this administration coming in saying they're going to try to reduce the government with efficiencies and reduce regulations. It was not clear sort of on net how that would work, because you could have an argument that there's an offset, that if they reduce regulations in other areas, that some companies would have less incentive to be involved in the public sector if regulation, the burden that is on companies from regulation is reduced. And tariffs are one of those, if you think about, you know, that influences companies' potential in markets, with many other factors at work, antitrust enforcement and other laws around safety and health and licensure. And, you know, there's many, many regulatory areas. Environmental, obviously, is a big one for certain sectors, all of which may be subject to change against what we've seen in the last 4 years going forward in the next administration.
Thank you very much. Just to finish up, let's have a look at freight markets. Paul, ocean container shipping, all this disruption to supply chains, especially the Red Sea crisis, has helped container lines post some big profits. They've also been ordering a lot of ships. In fact, the order book is almost 30% of the in-service fleet. I'm guessing you're expecting more profits for carriers next year, assuming these conditions all continue, and maybe a massive correction if there's any sort of normalization. Would that be around about right?
Well, right now, with the inefficiency, if you think of it that way, of the effective closure of the Suez Canal route that's used up, you know, what you can argue is something like 7 to 10% of that fleet capacity on just container shipping, let alone other types of shipping. If it's possible to achieve some reduction in the attacks and actually have some of the steamship lines revert to using the Suez route, that capacity instantly goes back onto the market and becomes a risk of an oversupply. And that's against a trade forecast that we have forecast for 2025, even at the baseline before these tariff imposition potential, of slower growth in both imports and exports in 2025 compared to 2024. So there's already some potential supply-demand imbalance, even before you have some of the additional vessel capacity fully playing out in the marketplace. Obviously, vessel scrapping is a factor. You know, how many of those advance to the breakers for the old ships? How much capacity comes out? I should remark that also affects freight shipping costs in domestic trucking in terms of supply and demand, where you have a supply factor as well as how much capacity comes out of the market, in addition to just the demand side that we're talking about here in shipping on every mode of transport. But in container shipping, especially, some of those factors at work look for some downside risk for rates for the carriers and some perhaps a welcome offset for shippers in 2025 if we don't have further disruptions that actually make trade, the capacity utilization and the shipping more complex. You know, that strike risk in January, weather conditions with water in the Panama Canal, all of which were there in 2024, were not clear are going to be gone in 2025. So there's still other disruption risks that could affect capacity deployed and therefore rates and shipping costs.
Kathy, how's that supply-demand balance in the air freight market? It's been quite tight at times this year. Same again next year. We're all looking at everything that comes down to demand, does it?
Yeah, it's going to be demand, and e-commerce is going to lead the way for our air cargo friends. I talked to a number of air cargo providers at the TIACA event, and they were all very positive on the volumes, e-commerce volumes leading the way, which is equating to continued higher air freight rates, air cargo rates, continuing at least through the first quarter, if not into the second quarter.
Thanks for that. In the next episode, Journal of Commerce veteran Peter Tershwell and Vespucci Maritime founder Lars Jensen will be joining me for a Christmas special when we'll be looking back at a rather wild 2024 and looking ahead to what 2025 holds. And as you've heard today, there really is a lot to digest ahead of the new year. But for now, thanks to all of you for listening. And of course, big thanks to my guests, Paul Bingham, Director for Transportation Consulting at S&P Global Market Intelligence, and Kathy Robeson, Founder of Logistics Trends and Insights. Please both come back soon.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Freight Buyers Club, produced in partnership with the Demerco Express Group. Please subscribe and follow on your platform of choice or sign up for delivery to your inbox at thefreightbuyersclub.com. This podcast wouldn't have been possible without the fantastic editing of Karen Ball and Tom Matthews. And finally, thank you all for listening. The next episode will be with you soon.